Well, good morning and welcome to WKU Libraries. I was thinking back the other day, 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago to this month, Mary Ellen Miller, Ann Robson, and a few friends and I met together to talk about the need for Kentuckians to have a greater awareness of our neighbor to the north, Canada. And after several years of planning, a Canadian Studies certificate was established and exchanges developed, which continue. And since that time, WKU Libraries have received more than $25,000 in grants from the Government of Canada. And in that spirit, it's a pleasure to have with us today one of Canada's most distinguished authors, a short story writer, novelist, and playwright. She's the author of 5 novels, 4 volumes of short stories, and countless plays, radio dramas, and scripts for television and film. She's taught creative writing and has served as writer-in-residence at universities across Canada, including one, a stint at my former alma mater, the University of Lethbridge, and most recently has been writer-in-residence at the University of Winnipeg in Manitoba. She grew up in Morris, Manitoba, the 5th of 11 children of a Russian Mennonite mother and a Métis father, and like most of her fictional characters, she lived most of her life on the prairies, settling first in Winnipeg and Manitoba, and later in Regina and Saskatchewan. In her fiction, she explores the lives of small-town characters, especially women. In her first short story collection, Night Travelers, published in 1982, and Ladies of the House, published in 1984, she explored the psychological problems of characters in rural and urban settings, including those of the Lafreniere family in the fictional town of Agassiz. Her first novel, The Missing Child, published in 1989, was also set in Agassiz, a town on the verge of being flooded by a melting underground glacier. Her 2001 novel, The Ruslander, is an epic family story set in early 20th century Russia, as recalled by Katya Boak, hope I'm getting that right, an elderly woman living in Winnipeg, Manitoba. She continues the Boak family saga in her most recent novel, Children of the Day, published in 2005. Her writings have been critically acclaimed, as she's been the recipient of numerous literary awards, including the W.H. Smith Books First Novel Award, the McNally Robinson Book of the Year Award, 2 Saskatchewan Books of the Year Award, a Silver Birch Award, a Red Cedar Award, and has been twice nominated for Canada's most distinguished literary prize, the Governor General's Award, and most recently nominated for a Giller Prize, which is Canada's most lucrative award at $40,000. Despite the acclaim, she remains approachable, has a great sense of humor, and tells wonderful stories, and just the kind of person to keep you entertained on that mythical desert island. Please give a warm welcome to Sandra Birdsong.
Thank you very much for that, Brian. I've been writing for a short time. I started writing late in life. I raised 3 children before I began to write. Started writing when I was about 35 when my father died, and I realized that there were a whole lot of things about him I didn't know, and I was very sorry that I hadn't caught up in his stories, and this set me on a path of telling stories. I don't want to tell you how many years ago that is, but I'm amazed that once I began to write, I like to say that I discovered I was like a duck that had found my pond, that I had been this duck waddling about on dry land all of my life, and once I began to write, I had found who I was. So the books came rather quickly after that. I'm going to read and talk a bit about the 2 books, the last books I've written, The Ruslander, which is just the name for Russian Mennonites who emigrated from Russia, and it's my mother's story in a way. She came when she was 12 years old. It's a story that we didn't know in Canada and needed to be told. It's not one I wanted to tell because I didn't like that Mennonite side of my heritage. I always thought they were the most boring people on earth, and I'm not sure that they still aren't, but nevertheless, I knew that I had to do it for one reason, and that's because I loved my grandparents. And they were called Schraders or Schroders. And they lived down the end of the road from where I lived. And my mother was always having babies or miscarriages. and it was 16 pregnancies in all, and maybe more. And so my grandfather, for some reason, my Opa Schrader, took great, he was very fond of me. And although he didn't speak much English, I spent a lot of time with him in his garden. And that's where I learned, he taught me so many, the things that he taught me have really worked well for me as a writer, in the sense that he taught me silence, patience, appreciation for detail, diligence, and a striving to do my absolute very best. However, the very first thing I ever wrote about Mennonites was in my short story collection, where I said, I didn't say actually, one of my characters said, being Mennonite was dull and dreary. It was like having acne. No one would ever invite you out, I said. And I thought it was sort of done with the Mennonites, having done that. However, that was not to be. And I found myself, it was so, God had said, okay, well, I'll make you pay for that comment or whatever, because the Ruslander was an odyssey of 7 years, actually. 7 years of travel, research, reading, writing, and learning things about this group of people that I never knew. I thought they were all sunflower seed-eating farmers. So it was such an astonishment for me to discover that these people living in Russia had built this vast colony of almost 500,000 people in villages all along what is now Ukraine, on both sides of the Dnieper River and down to the Black Sea. And that they were buying up land that the Russian noblemen could no longer afford to farm, because the emancipation of the serfs, of course, left them without people to tend their land, and Mennonites bought up so much of that land. And they were extremely wealthy, and some of them left the land, became manufacturers. There was a village, actually, a colony in this area that was called New York, and I was so amazed to find this name, New York, and there were pictures of it. And all industrialized, you know, industry, smokestacks, and it looked like a very small city set on the steppe. And I found out that the reason why they called it New York was because the Russian count that they had bought it from had once visited the United States and had gone to New York City, and that was its one stipulation, is that they call the settlement New York. So I asked my Plotdeutsch speaking Mennonite friends, how would you say New York in Low German? And they said, die große Apfel, or something like that. The Big Apple. Yeah. So I'm going to read a small part from the Ruslander, and then I'm going to read a small part from Children of the Day. And the reason why I'm going to do that is because when I started writing the Ruslander, what I really wanted to do was too many things. And one of the things I wanted to do was to explore the mix of cultures that came together on the prairie, Mennonite and Métis, Mennonite and French. And I found that I couldn't get these people out of Russia. So the novel, which is like a grand sweeping Russian novel, ends as they arrive in Canada. And Children of the Day, what happens to them after that, is a more modern, you'll see as I read, is a more modern text sort of, a much different form of writing than this book, and so they really, really and truly deserve to be apart, and I think work very well apart as separate novels. So the Mennonites are pacifists, and they were, one of the things that they kept moving from country to country was freedom not to bear arms. And so here they are in Russia, and it's the First World War, and that pacifism is being challenged, and so they're working as for the Red Cross, they're working in forestry, they're working on roads, rather than bearing arms. However, some of their factories are getting rich on this war, building wagons, etc., that will transport soldiers and ammunition, and so it's kind of controversial. They're getting rich while the Russian peasant is getting poorer and paying with their lives. Katya is the main character, and her father is going off to war. And I want to read this because it gives you a really good picture of the time, the place, the language of the book. And then I'm going to go on to this one. Katja is the main character in this book, and it's published here in the United States as Katja, and her sister Sarah is the main character in this book, Children of the Day. Katja would remember that the clouds were driven by the wind that cast shadows on the shorn fields on either side of the road, making the fields appear incandescent as patches of earth brightened to a yellow gold and faded to the usual monochromatic beige of autumn. All around her the land glowed and dimmed, and it was a remarkable thing to see how the landscape shadowed with running clouds seemed to turn itself on and off. And she stood very still, her slate gray eyes taking it in, wanting to remember the day that her father went to serve in the war. She watched with Gerhard and Sarah as the droshky taking her parents to Idukanadinislav reached the vanishing point and disappeared, and then they returned to the gatepost where Oma Schrader waited with baby Daniel clinging to her neck, Johan and Peter to her apron. Because the air was cool, she knew not to expect that her parents would be given back to them in an image projected above the road. She wouldn't see the usual wobbling amoeba go floating across the land when miles away the carriage turned onto the colony highway where north and went northwest to the pink and peach colored city of Ekaterinoslav, where her father had explained hundreds of men would soon camp on the platform of a station and wait to board a train for Moscow. Abram Zuderman had predicted that their father would likely be home from the war by Christmas, and most people thought the same, that the war would be over for Christmas. They wouldn't be away from home for longer than 5 months. Her mother had never been to Ekaterinoslav, a city named after the great empress, and she went for the first time, wanting to shorten, by a few days at least, the separation from her husband, just as many other women had done. But their encounter with the Russian city and life beyond their Mennonite oasis would make them anxious about their husbands and sons. They didn't fear the painted birds, the hoors, moving among the men at the train station, their seduction garish and as plain to see as the day. Rather, they feared the rosy and fair-cheeked Russian nurses their men would work alongside in the field hospitals and ships and trains, Sisters of Mercies, who, it was rumored, could be entirely too merciful. Katja's parents had been treated by Abram Zuderman to a stay in an ostentatious hotel in Ekaterinoslav. And the painted birds were even there, her mother told Oma when she returned. Abram was acquainted with the manager of the hotel, whose quick movements and glibness made her mother suspect he was afraid his true self would be revealed if he ever slowed down. He offered her parents a key to a private steam bath, which they declined. What with the presence of the painted birds, her mother was reluctant to sit where they might have sat. But they did accept the man's invitation to take supper in the hotel's elegant dining room, and they refrained from speaking German, and they were treated to music of a string ensemble of women musicians. The second night, they lodged in Isaac Zuderman's factory quarters, a suite that was made available to out-of-town business acquaintances in the three-story building across a courtyard from his tractor factory. The building where they stayed also housed several of Isaac Zuderman's factory workers and their families, whose workers had shown industry and promise and who had proven themselves to be worthy of higher education, which he provided for them in a classroom after work. Because of the impending war, the students' benches now stood empty. Isaac's factory was running at half its productivity, he complained to them as he took them on a tour. He would need to hire women, he said. If the war went on much longer than Christmas, it was likely he would be required to manufacture cannons and shell casings. "We're so rich, Mama," Katja's mother said to Oma when she returned, meaning that Mennonites had become rich. The extent of some people's wealth had been brought home to her. She wrung her hands in haste, made anxious by what she had seen in the city, Isaac's factory, his flour mill, the ornate and luxurious house Abram's married sons lived in, the servants all in uniform. She had seen a mansion owned by Mennonite, a man whom people weren't ashamed to call millionaire chaves, that occupied a full city block. There would be a price to pay for all of this, she predicted. And she quoted a biblical list of what could be bought in the world marketplace: gold and silver and pearls and fine linen and silk, and vessels of ivory and brass, and ointments and wine, and beasts and horses and chariots and slaves and the souls of men. Years later, Katja would hear their stories. She would relive the scene through the eyes of people who had been there. The platform shaking as locomotives drew in and out beneath the vaulted ceiling of the station, steam thick as wool in the chilly air, and obliterating the crowds that gathered across the tracks. Beyond the crowd was a broad tree-lined avenue whose omnibuses and carriages and automobiles went to and fro. The avenue opened to a central square, a statue of Pushkin, and gilt-trimmed and pastel-colored apartment buildings. She would remember the moment the droshky carrying her father and mother passed through the gates of Privolnoye, the clouds casting their shadows, the incandescent earth. The parlor clock ticked as usual, but its sound now became accentuated, became a counterpoint to the rhythm of her mother's footsteps when she returned, moving through the house in the months that followed as though feeling her way in the dark. Greta's departure for Arbuzovka to keep house for Willie and Frida Kron, their father's departure for 3 months medical training in Moscow, had left an aching silence. She would read, years later, about that particular autumn, when her father had gone away, about the crowds that had gathered in parks in Odessa to listen to military bands while enjoying ice cream on balmy summer-like evenings. People strolling in parks, wheeling baby carriages, their voices blending as they called out for war. In Berlin, Paris, London, there were similar parks and similar choirs whose thundering recitative had been all the same. That's as much as I'm going to read you that. And of course, the Tsar's family murdered, society breaks down, there's no police force. And the Russian Mennonites, who were extremely successful, immediately become targets for violence. And because Katja's, I try to portray the different levels of society, Mennonite society, the very wealthy estate owners. Katja's on an estate with her father, who works as a hired man there. They were the first victims. And so I have worked through archival material, and most of the violence in this book is stuff I have taken directly from the archives. The fact that the book opens with a murder massacre scene. And that's Katja's family. Her family is massacred. And she's saved. She and her sister Sarah are saved because her father has dug a hole in the greenhouse floor, and he has told his daughters there to run and hide there should there be violence. And she and her sister get away, and the rest are killed, and they come to Canada. Sarah was only 8 years old when that happened, and has never really dealt with it, the massacre. Katja has, through marriage, children, through spirit of forgiveness, lack of guilt that she has got from her husband, saying, it's nothing we did that was wrong. It was that we were in the wrong place at the wrong time, whereas a lot of Mennonites blame themselves for the violence that happened to themselves because they got too wealthy and didn't think of the poor around them enough. But Sarah was so young, she couldn't deal with her guilt, so she comes to Canada and she's working for the wealthy as a maid in the city of Winnipeg, and one day she meets a man who's driving a cab, and that man happens to be Oliver. And you'll find out how they meet, and they get married. This is a scene where he's taking her to see a house where he wants them to live. They're not married yet. And he's a guess what? He's French, Cree, Métis, and she's Russian. So it's my background in a way, because that was my upbringing. I mean, I was baptized Roman Catholic and brought up Mennonite. And I used to go down the road for a Sunday afternoon to spend with my Opa and Oma, and all I would hear would be Low German. And then I would go to St. Boniface for school vacation, and all I'd hear was French. and my grandmother Bertha Lett would tack a glowing phosphorescent crucifix on the wall over the couch where I was going to sleep, because she worried that I might be bringing some offending Protestant sort of evil spirits in my body. So I would lie on that couch looking at this glowing cross, and of course my mother always said, you know, because Mennonites, you know, didn't have icons of any sort, they just wouldn't tolerate them. And she used to say, the problems with the Catholics are that they leave Christ on the cross. And he's not there, he's risen, you see. And I used to hear that Roman Catholics were poor Babylon, and they were hiding guns in their basement for the time when they were going to take over the world. I would have had a young sister next to me who died of leukemia, and she was not given the last rites or buried in a Roman Catholic cemetery, so of course my Roman Catholic cousins told me she'd gone to hell or was in purgatory, which really devastated my mother when they said, how come Annette's in hell? And then on the other hand, here was my father, beautiful, dark-haired man, dark-eyed man, who came from a family where they had the gift of healing, the gift of stopping hemorrhaging. His mother was a midwife, and her mother before her and before her, and was reputed to have a medicine bag that she used to wear that would stop bleeding or help in the healing. And he never wanted it. It was to be given to the oldest person. He never wanted it. However, my dad was a barber in a small town, which meant that he would often go to the hospitals and give a shave and a haircut to a dying man or a dead man. And so he would come home, and you would have the deepest thing coming out of him, this mysticism somehow, that he was the wisest man. He'd come home and say, oh, well, Jack Hamlin's got cancer of the liver, and he'll be gone in 2 days, I'm sure of it. And sure enough, Jack Hamlin would die of cancer 2 days later. So I grew up thinking my dad had some magical powers. And when he used to tell me, you know what, we're living at the bottom of a lake. And it was. We were living at the bottom of ancient Lake Agassiz. And the Red River would flood constantly. And we'd have to tear out of our home and go for the hills and then come back, and our home would be partially destroyed. And he used to say that lake was going to come back one day. And I always imagined then, from then on, that I was indeed living at the bottom of the lake, and that the birds were fish, and that the sky was the lid of the lake where I lived. And so water has constantly been in all, and floods have always been in my work from the very beginning. Even the children's book, The Town That Floated Away, is about a flood that sweeps everything away. And my first book was a Bible, and the illustrations in the Bible were, of course, you know, Noah's flood. And here were all these people stranded on the last mountaintop. Babies were falling in water, and the wife was being pulled up the slope by a husband, and this is what happened to you if you were sinful. It was just the most wonderful thing for a child to see, actually. And I think that, you know, it was strange for me to have grown up learning to do the hula hoop, you know, and then contemplating the nature of good and evil at the same time. I'm going to heaven, I'm going to hell, I'm going to hell. You know? So I have to say, like, is it any wonder that I turned out to be a writer? Maybe it's a blessing, I don't know. I'm not that, could be a dragon dick. But you don't know that I'm not. So Sarah is pregnant with Oliver's child. He's taking her to see an old hotel. He manages an old run-down hotel in a part of Manitoba that history is being swept away. It's there on the edge of history, of an old time that is gone. Like, my father had buffalo head on the walls. He had the old marble barber chairs. He had a buffalo coat that he wore that we used to almost suffocate under when it fell on us. And so he's there. And he's got Sarah pregnant, and they're going to start their marriage there. The house had always been there long before Oliver's time, but he hadn't given it more than an occasional curious appraisal when passing by, until it appeared he might be faced with the possibility of raising a family in a moribund hotel. "Come and see this house I found," Oliver said to Sarah, and she was as eager to view it as he was to show it to her. As they came near to the house, Oliver said Sarah's growing disquiet. "Well, what do you think?" he dared to ask. They stood before it, Sarah cupping her hands and blowing to warm them, the biting November wind sweeping grainy snow across the road in front of the house and down into the overgrown yard. She shrugged and made for the door, and Oliver followed. She stood in the main and largest room, struck silent as she stared at drawings on a wall that would eventually become a wall in her kitchen. "Pictures," Oliver explained, unnecessarily. He'd asked around, and he'd learned that years ago, the family of Assiniboine had squatted for a short time before being encouraged to move on. Likely, the pictures were their doing. The drawings were red and looked as though they'd been made by very young and artistically inept children. They were stick men mounted on horses, shooting arrows into a herd of buffalo. And in another, men were killing each other with lances and arrows. "It's an Indian war party," Oliver said, when Sarah wrapped her arms about herself and shivered. "It's a killing," she said. "Well, we'll throw on some whitewash, is all she needs for sure. I know there's mouse dirt the rabbits have got in," he continued, when she didn't seem convinced. "The house," he said, "she has somewheres to go, I know." From what little he knew of Sarah, Oliver sensed that potential inspired hope. That was why, like most immigrants, she'd come to the country in the first place, for a new life, for the reason of hope. "We'll get a Quebec heater for the small room and a cook stove in here," he said, "and you'll see, Sarah, we're going to be snugger than a bug in a rug." He began pacing, his hands slicing the air as he spoke too quickly for her to fully comprehend, nor had she understood the concept of snugness in a rug. "The two rooms would be filled with fiddle music," he said, "and with sit-down dancers when his St. Boniface relations came visiting in winter." He vowed that he and Sarah would cross the Red River to the French side to attend the winter carnivals and the snowshoe and horse and dog races a new priest in the parish of St. Agathe had taken to organizing. They were going to go house to house on New Year's Eve to celebrate in the French way, as he used to do, firing his rifle into the wind and begging the favor of a drink and a kiss. "I have relations coming out of my ears up and down the river," he told her. "As far south as St. Joe and Pembina," he said, "the Carons, the Brissolettes, the Broncaniers, the Dubois, the St. Germains, the Delormes," and he recited all the names that he knew, their syllables like a church bell tolling across the snowbound land. "No guns. There won't be any guns here," Sarah interrupted, as though laying down a condition to her agreeing to make the house their home. She had promised her older sister, Concha, no guns. "And there'll be no crosses either," she now added, meaning crucifixes on the wall. "And there'll be no strong drink. No dancing," she said, reminding him of who she was, a Mennonite, one of a few people who throughout the centuries had fled various countries for the freedom to practice their religious beliefs. "You don't say," Oliver said, after moments of silence. "But Katya didn't say we shouldn't do that," Sarah said. Her smile was a suggestive one as she spoke, her gray eyes like a radiant hardness beneath the brim of her hat. "You and I know the things we have done," her eyes told him. Her felt hat was the color of pigeons, its band of feathers iridescent shades of blue. It was too large, and the rim rode the low on her forehead, making her eyes look perpetually watchful. Her hips shifted beneath her dark wool coat as she went to the open door, the pear shape of her bottom emerging when she stooped to pick up a wooden crate. She set it down in the center of the room, stepped onto it so that she might look Oliver eye to eye. And then she raised her arm and she proclaimed in German, "There will be no drinking. You must not have any fun." Although Oliver knew she was walking, he heard her sister Katja's admonitions echo in the walls. Wasn't necessary for him to understand German to know that Sarah's people considered him to be a little rough around the edges. Her round young cheeks were rosy from the crisp air. Her small pink mouth turned up in the beginning of a self-conscious smile. He remembered the incredible softness of her skin next to her heat, the blue crepe dress she wore beneath the coat, a new dress he'd noticed before they'd set out, its tiny pearl buttons marching up between the mounds of her breasts, which were surprisingly full and heavy for such a small woman. He wanted to make her sweat and moan on his narrow bed in his hotel room under the stairs, stealth, the necessity for quiet, driving his blood hot, her teeth grazing and nipping at his palm. But the hotel was at the other end of town, and they were here, and he was ready. He caught Sarah by the window. He was driven by her protest to chase her across the room. "Not here, not now, it's too cold. Someone will come, the floor is dirty," she said. And she tried to twist out of his arms and reached to steady herself, and her hand came upon a leather thong looped onto a nail beside the window frame. "Was it us?" she asked. For moments, their hard breathing was the only sound as she held the pouch up between them, its leather stained and smelling of strong tea. "Well, you got me buffaloed," Oliver joked, knowing that the beaded orange and white pouch was a striker light and held the means to spark a fire. Sarah burst into laughter. "You understood me," she said. "You understood German. You can if you want to." And then she turned the pouch, and she threw the pouch out the window into the yard where the bleached grasses of summer lay flattened under a hard covering of snow. "Liebst du mich?" she asked, and then once again in English, "Did you really love me?" And when he nodded, she removed her hat, and she hooked it onto the nail beside the window frame, and her light brown hair was a cap of soft waves tucked and pinned under at the back of her head, revealing the shape of her small skull. Then she untied the belt of her wraparound coat and let it slide from her shoulders onto the floor. Oliver clasped Sarah to his chest, and he thought with a pang of worry, she wasn't much taller than the day he'd first seen her on the ferry. 8 years later, that girl had become this woman he was holding in his arms, though she didn't look grown enough to bear, and she didn't look grown enough to bear children. Beyond the window lay the strike-a-light pouch on the snow, its babiche thongs crumpled beside it. He said, "My own little pig, my dear, of course I love you." Sarah, satisfied for the moment, stepped out of his embrace and began unfastening the buttons of her dress, lest he try to do it for her, and half of them wound up scattered across the floor. A little while later, Oliver Vandel, Sarah Vogt's gypsy-looking man, her thin as a real man with wild, dark eyes, lay on the floor beside her. He was spent, and he was drifting towards a gentle snore, dreaming of his house, its open doors and windows welcoming a bit of rain, the scuttle of autumn leaves, a fox crossing its doorsill. He dreamt that he would take Sarah roaming into the country, and he would take her out amid the booming and echoing dance of the prairie hens among the red dogwood, and he'd show her its bark, and they would pulverize it, and they would put it in a pipe, and they would smoke what his grandmother had called kinnikinick. He was about to become a chef de famille, and he would see to it that the children they brought up into this world, the baby already sparked to life inside her, grew up to be children of experience and were not, by God, taken over by civilization. "Whose house is this?" Sarah asked, her eyes growing heavy. Despite the chill of the room, she wanted to sleep. Her hairpins had worked loose and strands as fine as cobwebs tickled his neck as she breathed. "Your guess is as good as mine," he said. "I don't know, but what does it matter? It's empty. It should be put to good use." And they did. Well, I think I've taken all the time. 20 years later, they have 10 children. And the novel begins on a day when Sarah refuses to get out of bed, and she's never done this before. And the novel started in my head like this. In all the almost 20 years the Vandel children had known their mother, she had never cried. And that's how the novel used to start. My editor and I had some problems there. The book doesn't start like that anymore, but nevertheless, it's like in the first act you put a gun, right? They say in the first act you put a gun, by the third act the gun's got to go off. So true. by the end of the novel, Sarah cries. And of course, that's the beginning of her healing of the massacre. But inside the novel, the 10 children go off and do all sorts of things and come quite near to the brink of disaster. So the novel is one day, from morning to night. The end of the day, the Métis and all her side of the family and the Mennonite side of the family get together in a room and they duke it out. And at the end of the novel, this family is dragged into the 20th century, down the road with their house. So you can see perhaps how the two don't fit together, but they just wouldn't have fit together, and how they sort of stand together quite well on their own. So I'm going to end now. And I don't know if we're allowing for questions. If there are any questions, yes.
Have you written any nonfiction or autobiography?
I'm only starting. Just starting. I haven't, up until now. I've written a couple essays that sound pretty memoirish, you know?
Yeah.
But not published. Thank you. Yes.
Do your novels and your plays cover similar themes? And if so, how did you decide which genre to use?
Oh, interesting. I think I've always been a novelist. And my first short story collections, they call them interconnected stories. In fact, the American publication of those two collections calls it a novel in stories. And I just think I didn't have enough time. And I had children when I was writing. I had three of them. One was going to university, another was, but I had one in grade three when I started to write. So I didn't have enough time to spin out a novel, and so I did the short stories. But I think I'm always a novelist. I don't know if you look at my websites and some of the Michael Ndaatje has written an endorsement for me. He said, besides saying I'm probably the best writer in Canada, he says. that I have this grand sweep, full canvas. I write with full canvas, and it's true, I do. And I can't write short stories anymore. I've tried, but I can't.
But plays?
Oh, plays are totally different. Yeah, of course. The language works differently there, and the arc, the story arcs are much more definite. And I've only written plays because I've been commissioned to write plays. It's not something I want to do, but there was this grand movement to see, I wonder what novelists would do with the play form. Well, here's $5,000, would you like to try? Oh, gosh, no. But I did write poetry, but I've never published any of it. Had to write poetry for a creative writing class at the University of Manitoba, and my professor, at the end of the class, they published that. And I wanted them to choose one of my short stories that had been published, and they chose a couple really horrible poems. And I said, why did you do that? And the professor said, well, look at it this way, Sandra. One day people are going to go back, and they're going to read that journal, and they're going to say, that's Sandra Birdsell. She really is a novelist, isn't she? Any other questions? Yes?
Would you speak about your writing process?
Well, I'm writing right now. So that'll tell you something. I don't know why I'm here in Kentucky, but I knew I had to come. And I know that besides to see Margaret, of course. Sorry. Of course. I had a place to stay. That's very crass. Horrible. But it's not like that. I'm writing a novel called Camping Out in the Malls of North America. And I'm thinking about a whole lot of things, and really there's a couple in a house trailer on a Walmart parking lot. And this is where it starts. And the man has lost his business, and he's going off to, you've all heard of the oil sands in Fort McMurray, Alberta, that is generating all the prosperity in Canada. That's where everyone's going, that's where he's going. I think there's a new area of study by academics called post-petroleum literature. Maybe this will end up in that canon, post-petroleum literature, of the bottom falling out of our economy and jobs lost and how the price of gas destroyed my first husband's business back in the 70s and 80s, and it's doing it again in some areas. So this is what I'm writing about. And so I'm here, and one of the things I really wanted to see here, but I don't know if I will, is a Pentecostal church. I just wanted to go in to see how they work. because I've seen them on TV, but I've never really stood in one and felt what goes on in those services. I think on one hand I'm terrified to go, on the other hand I'm curious enough to overcome my terror and go. I don't know if it'd be a good thing for me to do, but I thought if there was one that was on the street, you know, this happened, and this happened, I'd go and see it. I'm also curious to know what you look like and sound like, and what your stores look like. You live in paradise. I have to tell you, you do. It's just great. And this is one big park here in Bowling Green. Everything's so clean. It's so fresh, and it's marvelous. I mean, we live, our houses have to be constructed like fortresses against the cold and the weather, and every spring all these huge potholes open up that you can, your car drops in, and you have to sue the city for your front axle. It's terrible. We were in the Mammoth Caves yesterday, and they were explaining how this extreme drop in temperature at one point caused the part of the cave ceiling the one and only time to fall, and that was because of potholes, because of the force that the cold weather had caused this. I'm saying, well, welcome to our world. You can even buy a pothole, and then they'll put your name beside it and say, repair it, Sandy Birdsell. I gave you $200 to fix this pothole. And our walls are about this thick, of course, with insulation and stuff. But so I can see how it would be easier to build here, and less expensive, and everything looks bright and shiny and new and in good repair, and it's wonderful. Yes.
In your children today, you have a lot of children, a lot of characters.
Yes.
Is it complicated to write so many characters?
Yes, it was. It's 10 children, and which ones to focus on, and I do focus on several, and I focused on the oldest because of her tremendous sense of responsibility. Focused on one of the sons because Sarah's sons were darling and could do no wrong. I focused on the 5-year-old who was left to care for the two little ones while everyone goes off to school. And I focused on a middle child who is basically kidnapped by a man who picks her up in a car for the day while Sarah's in bed crying. And children don't fall in cisterns and drown, and one of the sons walks across a bridge and could fall off the bridge. And also, but how do I, so I decided on a sort of, how can I use them for the drama, and what can I say with it? I couldn't obviously do all of them. But nevertheless, every child is identified in some way. Well, even if she's not focused on this one who's growing breasts, and she keeps walking around and doing that to see if they're still there, you know? And you remember her for that, right? You do. Sorry, I mean, I hit. But I love writing children's voice.
Yeah. Other questions?
Is there time for one more?
Yes.
In what way is Canadian literature different from American literature?
I don't really know, because I don't know a lot about American literature, I must confess. I mean, I have some favorite authors that I go back to, and some favorite authors who are dead that I influenced me greatly when I was growing up, such as Flannery O'Connor and Grace Paley and authors like that. But how are they different? Well, I can, basically Canadian literature, though, I keep saying that we don't have lines of romance novel writers or fiction writers that come, or mystery writers that they come down here to publish. I always say that Canadian writing is like all classical music. There's no country western, and that it's kind of high tone, and you won't find a publisher for your mystery book there. It has to be. So I think in that way maybe it's different. Yeah. I think because it came out of academia at first, people who first began our literature is history. It's very, very short. Yeah. Used to be able to read every novel that was published in Canada in a year. I used to be able to read, but I can't anymore. It's impossible.
Well, I'd like to invite Peggy Wright to a little token of our appreciation for your visit here today. And we have brought a few, we had quite a few books, most of them, Vincent. We have a few left. If you'd like to get a copy of one of Sandra's books, they're $15, and she'll be, I'm sure, happy to sign one over here.
He talks forever, so I'm going to get in here and get my
and so do I.
And I'm going to say this will not take you to heaven, it will not take you to hell, but it will take you to tell you that Winston wishes.
Oh.
Very
well. Somewhere in between, right? Are you Catholic?
How did you get? We'd like to invite you to join us in the reception at that back, and feel free to come chat with Sandra.
I really want to.